It is Friday, May 8th, and welcome to Crea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. A push to hold a referendum on constitutional revision alongside the June 3rd local elections has collapsed after the main opposition People Power Party vowed a filibuster. More on that in news briefing. On In Depth, we're looking at the upward trend of sold apartment prices, the government's new tax measures for multi-home owners, which take effect from tomorrow, and the question of whether stock market gains are flowing back into real estate. And on Movie Spotlight, we discuss the glossy sequel The Devil Wears Prada 2 and Hong Sang-soo's latest arthouse film, The Day She Returns. Let's start Crea 24 right now. National Assembly Speaker Uwan Sheikh pounded the gavel at the National Assembly, announcing that the ruling Democratic Party-led push to hold a national vote on amending the constitution in time for the June 3rd local elections has collapsed. The decision came after the main opposition People Power Party vowed to launch a filibuster, ending the first serious attempt at constitutional change in 39 years. To tell us more about the wrangling in Parliament, as well as some of our other headlines of the day, we have now with us in the studio our KBS World News editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Alana.
Hee-jin, the push for a national referendum on the constitutional amendment was initially put forth by six parties, including the ruling DP, to coincide with the June 3rd local elections.
That's right. Speaker Uwan Sheikh declared on Friday that he would not bring the amendment to the floor after the opposition People Power Party vowed a filibuster, effectively halting the procedures for the June 3rd referendum. Let's listen to what he had to say as he made the announcement.
정말 이건 있을 수 없는 일입니다. 어떻게든 39년 만에 개헌을 무산시키지
I reconvene today's plenary session to do whatever it takes to keep this first attempt at constitutional revision in 39 years from collapsing. But seeing them respond with a filibuster, I have come to the conclusion that there is no point in proceeding any further.
그런데 이렇게 필리버스터로 응답하는 걸 보니까
The proposed amendment aimed for a phased revision, deliberately setting aside contentious issues like restructuring the executive branch. Instead, it sought to begin with provisions that had broad agreement, such as tightening the requirements for declaring martial law.
And Hee-jin, what was the purpose of the amendment?
Well, the amendment would have enshrined the spirit of the Busan Masan democratic uprising and the May 18th Gwangju democratization movement. Movement in the Constitution's preamble. It also aimed to enhance parliamentary oversight of martial law and include a constitutional commitment to balanced regional development. The main opposition PPP said it agreed with the substance of the amendment but opposed it as a politically motivated push tied to the upcoming election, making opposition the official party line.
And the top office expressed regret over the failure.
Yes, the presidential office expressed regret over the failed constitutional amendment, saying the PPP's opposition would be difficult for the public to accept. President spokesperson Kang Yu-jung said in a written statement that it will be difficult for the public to understand why minimal changes to the constitution aimed at protecting the nation's safety and democracy were opposed, and added that discussions to amend the constitution must continue. The current constitution was last written in 1987. Successive efforts to update it have repeatedly fallen apart amid partisan disputes, and this latest attempt has now followed that pattern, with any further debate likely to be pushed back until the local elections on June 3rd.
Let's now look at some of our other headlines of the day. Im Sung-gun, the former commander of the Marine Corps 1st Division, has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for the death of young Corporal Choi Soo-gun in 2012. 2023. Can you tell us more about that verdict?
Well, the Seoul Central District Court on Friday handed down the sentence after Im was convicted of occupational negligence, resulting in the death and violating the Military Criminal Act. The Marine Special Counsel Team led by Lee Myung-un had previously requested a 5-year prison term. Im was found guilty of ordering search operations for victims of heavy rains in Yeochon, North Gyeongsang Province in July 2023 without providing life vests or any other safety equipment. Corporal Che, who was a private at the time, was involved in the search operation and died after being swept away in a swollen stream. The court stated that Im's unreasonable and aggressive search orders, motivated by a desire for tangible results, contributed to the fatal accident.
Taking a look now at the nation's economy, South Korea has posted its largest ever monthly current account surplus of $37.33 billion in March on the back of a semiconductor upcycle, continuing a streak of surpluses for the 35th straight month. Can you break down the figures for us?
Well, according to provisional data from the Bank of Korea released Friday, the cumulative surplus during the first 3 months of the year reached $73.78 billion, 3.8 times what it was for the same period last year. The goods account also hit a record surplus of $35.07 billion after exports jumped 56.9% from the previous year to an all-time high of $94.32 billion. Shipments of semiconductors surged 149.8%, and those of computer peripherals increased 167.5%. Imports rose 17.4% to $59.24 billion. The services account posted a deficit of $1.29 billion, though the travel balance saw a surplus of $140 million following K-pop sensation BTS comeback show in Seoul and in March. It was the first surplus for the tourism sector in 11 years and 4 months.
In other headlines, representatives of management and labour at Samsung Electronics will resume negotiations next week, with labour authorities mediating in hopes of averting a strike later this month. Heejun, what's the latest there?
Well, the company's labour union said Friday it will take part in a post-mediation procedure in which the National Labour Relations Commission resumes efforts to mediate a dispute with the consent of both labour and management after formal mediation procedures have ended. The announcement came after a meeting between labour chief Choi Sung-ho and Kim Do-hyung, chief of the Gyeonggi branch of the Ministry of Employment and Labour, followed by a tripartite meeting that also included company representatives. During the meeting, the Labour Ministry reportedly strongly urged both sides to take part in the mediation process and pledged full government support for the negotiations. The post-mediation sessions are scheduled to take place Monday and Tuesday, although the union said preparations for a general strike set for May 21st would continue. The union chief warned that workers would proceed with a planned strike if negotiations fail to produce a satisfactory outcome for union members.
Let's now turn to the latest from the Middle East. Hopes for peace talks between the United States and Iran have been rattled after the two sides exchanged military strikes on Thursday in and around the Strait of Hormuz, putting their fragile ceasefire under renewed strain. Tell us more.
Well, the latest strikes between the United States and Iran came just a day after U.S. media reported that Washington and Tehran were close to signing a one-page memorandum of understanding covering key issues, including the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, limits on Iran's nuclear program, and sanctions relief. Expectations for a dramatic agreement had also run high ahead of U.S. President Donald Trump's planned visit to China this week, with Trump himself stating in a PBS interview that a deal could be reached before the trip. All that changed after the U.S. military said it struck Iranian military facilities in self-defense after Iranian attacks in the strait, while Iran accused Washington of violating the ceasefire by targeting vessels and civilians, civilian areas, and said it responded with retaliatory attacks on U.S. warships. Despite the clash, both sides signaled they were seeking to avoid a broader escalation.
In related news, the South Korean-operated cargo ship that was damaged in an explosion at subsequent fire in the Strait of Hormuz has arrived in Dubai for an investigation. What's the status of that freighter?
Well, according to ship operator HMM, the HMM Namu was towed from waters off Al-Quain in the United Arab Emirates, where it had been anchored and was fully docked at the Marina Dry Docks World Dubai by 3:20 a.m. Friday local time. The South Korean government team, comprising three investigators from the Korea Maritime Safety Tribunal and four experts from the National Fire Agency, arrived in Dubai on Thursday to look at the cause of the explosion. The investigation is expected to focus on whether the external factors, such as an attack, were at play, or whether a malfunction of the vessel caused the explosion. The explosion took place on Monday, the same time the United States launched a now-suspended initiative called Project Freedom to guide vessels through the strait amid an effective shutdown by Iran.
And finally for today, the benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index closed at an new all-time high on Friday, finishing just shy of the 7,500 mark. Heejin, give us those closing figures.
Well, the KOSPI rose 7.95 points, or 0.11%, to close at 7,498, marking its fourth consecutive session of gains. This closing surpassed the previous close record of 7,490.05 set a day earlier, despite continued heavy selling by foreign investors following a record sell-off the previous day. Strong buying from retail investors helped lift the index. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also gained 8.54 points, or 0.71%, to close at 1,207.72, snapping a three-session losing streak. Meanwhile, the South Korean won buckled against the U.S. dollar by 17.71, trading at 1,471.71 per dollar as of 3:30 p.m.
And that's it for our news briefing. Thanks so much, Heejin, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is conductor Holly Hyun Che, or Che Hyun. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Ahead of the government's plan to impose heavier capital gains taxes on multi-home owners from Saturday, Seoul apartment prices continued to rise this week. The affluent Gangnam was the only major district to post a decline from the previous week, while several other high-priced areas returned to growth. The figures suggest that despite repeated cooling measures, the government is still struggling to rein in Seoul's housing market, a trend that has continued since apartment prices began climbing again in 2025. The Lee Jae-myung administration has sought to redirect household wealth away from real estate and into the stock market, and that effort has appeared to produce results. The benchmark KOSPI has more than doubled in less than a year, setting a fresh all-time high this week, despite continued risks from the war in the Middle East. It closed Friday at 7,498. But that success has come with an ironic twist. Some investors are now using gains from the stock market to buy expensive apartments in Seoul, potentially undercutting the administration's broader housing strategy. To discuss South Korea's high apartment prices and the government's efforts to contain them, we're joined today by two guests. First, we have Korea Jeongang Daily reporter Jin Min-ji, who has been following this issue. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Jin.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined on the line by Jun Jae-sik, Professor of Real Estate Studies at Konkuk University and an expert on South Korea's housing market and real estate policy. Great to have you with us, Professor Jun.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the government's policy response, let's first establish for our listeners where the market stands now and, of course, how we got here. Ms. Jin, can you first summarise the recent rise in housing prices in Seoul and the surrounding capital region? And when did this upward trend begin and how long it's continued for?
Sure. Seoul's housing market has seen pronounced volatility over the past year, with prices largely trending upwards. The gains have been driven by tighter real estate regulations and the shortage of the housing supply in the capital. If we look back, even before the Lee Jae-myung administration took office in June last year, apartment prices were already gaining traction. That momentum was supported by the central bank's monetary easing cycle, which boosted liquidity and a widening supply gap. This year, new housing supply in Seoul is expected to reach only about 55% of the estimated annual demand of roughly 47,000 units, so the imbalance is quite pronounced. For its part, the government has rolled out a series of measures to cool the market with a broader aim of redirecting capital from real estate into equities. These have included tighter mortgage lending rules and the removal of capital gains tax benefits for multi-home owners from May 9th. Since taking the office, President Lee Jae-myung has pursued an aggressive anti-speculation stance on real estate, warning investors not to test the government and vowing that market speculation would not prevail against policy measures. Even so, the impact has been quite limited, with housing demand proving more resilient than had been expected. In terms of the numbers, KB real estate data shows that the average apartment price in Seoul reached 1.56 billion won as of April. That marks an 18% increase from a year earlier, following a cumulative rise of nearly 9% last year, which itself was the strongest annual gain in 19 years. Looking at the broader metropolitan area, including Gyeonggi and Incheon, prices were also up, rising about 12% year-on-year in April.
So that gives us a clearer picture of the domestic trend. But, you know, Seoul's housing market, it's often discussed not only in local terms, but also in comparison with other major global cities. Ms. Jin, how exactly do housing prices in Seoul compare with those in other countries or major cities?
Even when you compare Seoul with major global cities, its residential property prices are firmly in the top tier. According to a Savills research report released in February, the average price of prime residential homes in Seoul stands at $1,730 per square foot, ranking it 10th globally. That places it behind cities such as Tokyo, Geneva, New York, London, and Shanghai. And at the top of the list, Hong Kong leads by a wide margin, with average prices of around $3,730 per square foot. The report also points to the structural factors underpinning Seoul's pricing. It notes that prime apartment values continue to be shaped by long-standing constraints, including limited available land, slow development pipelines, and highly concentrated demand in established core districts. It explained that while tighter regulations and more restrictive financing conditions have weighed on transaction volumes, they have so far done little to ease underlying price pressures. Looking ahead, Savills expects Seoul to be one of the strongest performers in the prime residential segment. It forecasts price growth of between 5.6 and 7.9% this year, the highest among the cities covered. That compares with projected gains of roughly 4 to 5.9% for cities such as Tokyo, Madrid, and Lisbon. Some other research institutions point to an even more elevated picture of Seoul's pricing position. In a separate report from the Deutsche Bank Research Institute published last June, the average unit price in Seoul was estimated at about $2,125 per square foot, up 32% over the past 5 years and ranking fourth globally, behind only Hong Kong, Switzerland, and Singapore. The report also showed that Seoul's price levels have now moved ahead of several major global cities, including New York and London.
Professor Jun, what are the main reasons behind these high housing prices in the South Korean capital? And why has the government, you know, really struggled so far to contain them?
The current situation is the result of complex interactions among factors such as supply-demand imbalance, unintended responses to strong regulations, and the dynamics inherent to the unique Korean rental system. First, the Seoul housing market suffers from a severe supply shortage, as you just heard, for more than a decade. Admin delays and restrictive regulations on urban redevelopment projects have created a severe shortage of new housing in Seoul, while demand remains high. Second, we observe the backlash against strong regulations. Heavy tax penalties on multi-homeowners and strict mandatory owner residency rules have sparked a pushback through the consolidation of real estate portfolios. While the regulations had a short-term effect on price stabilization, over time they facilitate the so-called one smart home strategy, in which multi-homeowners sell other properties to hold on to a single prime asset in Seoul. So this phenomenon has driven capital into high-tier assets in Seoul. Finally, the unique rental market system in Korea has created a self-reinforcing upward pressure. As Seoul's prices became unaffordable, many potential buyers were forced to remain in the rental market, sustaining robust demand. Conversely, on the supply side, regulatory interventions prevented multi-homeowners from supplying rental units. This mismatch triggered a sharp escalation, especially in 전세 prices. And this also has impact on the gap investment, which is a unique practice where home buyers use the tenant's high 전세 deposit as leverage to purchase the home with little equity. So the government put many regulations targeting those practice, but these measures tend to be ineffective in Seoul's high-end market as the participants are dominated by high-income and or high-net-worth households, because landlords and tenants in these wealthy areas have enough cash and rarely need bank loans. Mm-hmm. The government's strict borrowing limits simply don't affect them. So therefore, when 전세 prices rise, they act as a safety net and eventually push selling prices even higher.
Mm-hmm. And 전세, of course, being the housing deposit. As we've briefly touched on, one of the E administration's broader goals has been to try and steer household money away from real estate and toward financial markets. Now, the stock market, as we've seen, has absolutely surged, but that may actually be creating this unexpected feedback loop. Ms. Jin, you recently reported on this issue. The E government has sought to shift this money away from real estate into the KOSPI, the KOSDAQ markets, and it has succeeded in boosting stocks. But your report suggests that some of those gains are actually flowing back into the housing market. Can you explain for our listeners what's happening?
Sure. While KOSPI has staged a powerful rally since last year, climbing from the 2000 range to recently break above 7,500, a growing share of those gains appears to be flowing into the property market. Government data shows proceeds from sales of stocks, bonds, and cryptocurrencies accounted for 9.3% of funding used to purchase homes priced above 1.5 billion won in Seoul during the first quarter. The period coincided with the KOSPI breaking above 5,000 in January and 6,000 in February. The share funded by financial asset sales was roughly double the level seen over the previous 5 years, underscoring how equity market gains are increasingly being recycled into real estate purchases. Buyers in their 30s accounted for the largest volume of home purchase funding sourced from financial asset sales, totaling 721.1 billion won in the first quarter. That tendency was also highlighted in a Bank of Korea report released Thursday. According to the central bank, households in Korea spend just 1.3% of capital gains from stocks on goods and services, which is well below the roughly 3% to 4% seen in the United States and Europe. The report attributed the gap largely to the redirection of investment gains into real estate, limiting the boost to consumer spending typically associated with rising equity prices. The central bank said that among households without homes, roughly 70% of capital gains from stock investments were funneled into the property market.
Professor Jun, as an expert in this field, I want to get your reaction to Ms. Jin's reporting. How do you assess this link between the stock market gains and the renewed demand for Seoul housing?
I would analyze this trend by comparing it to the corporation's asset parking strategy. When large corporations generate activities, they rarely reinvest 100% of these profits back into R&D or their business expansion. Mm-hmm. Instead, they strategically allocate a significant portion of their surplus capital to purchase prime real estate. They are essentially parking the wealth generated from risky ventures into the most reliable, safe place to hedge against inflation and permanently preserve their asset value. I believe individuals in Korea are implementing the same rational decision-making process. Many retail investors view the stock market as a stepping stone, not the final destination for their wealth. When they make a solid profit from their stocks, they would proceed to park those newly acquired gains into the ultimate safe haven of the Korean capital market, which is the premium apartments in Seoul. This behavior is deeply rooted in historically learned lessons. Through decades of experience, Korean investors have learned that real estate simply yields the highest long-term returns. And within that market, Seoul apartments are considered the best investment because they offer unparalleled liquidity, mm-hmm. Meaning they are very easy to sell and turn back into cash, in addition to the highest profitability. Although the government wants people to invest more capital, more in the stock market boom gives people the extra cash that they need to finally buy high-end real estate. As long as Koreans hold this belief, liquidity created in the stock market will likely flow back into the real estate market.
It almost seems like it's kind of a vicious cycle now at this point, which brings us to one of the government's most immediate measures to try and address this issue. Starting Saturday, heavier capital gains taxes on multi-home owners are set to return with the aim of encouraging more property sales and easing price pressure. Professor John, with the heavier tax on multi-home owners taking effect, what should we expect going forward? And for potential home buyers, would you recommend buying now or waiting until prices perhaps stabilize?
First of all, I would like to discuss about the policy effectiveness mm-hmm. about this one, the regulations. In the short term, it appears to be achieving its intended effect. When we look at the data from February to now, many people try to sell their properties in order to avoid this heavy capital gains tax ends. In March, the transaction volumes increased in large cities outside the Seoul metropolitan area, such as Daejeon, Busan, and Daegu. That was the beginning. And then by April, the surge hit Seoul and Gyeonggi area. So in Seoul's expensive regulated areas like Gangnam, Seocho, Songpa, Yongsan, the increased inventory led to a slight price drop up to 1% between February and April. Consequently, the ratio of multi-homeowners has dropped to a four-year low. However, the landscape will shift in the long term. As we all know, starting tomorrow, the grace period for the heavy capital gains tax ends. With that ending, property holding taxes are expected to rise soon. We anticipate a market contraction. When sales transactions freeze, people are forced into rental market, driving up 전세 and even monthly rental prices. As we know, rising rental prices inevitably push up sales prices. Furthermore, in a stagnant market with very few transactions, just one or two record high sales can inflate all listing prices, creating a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. Market participants have learned from past experience again that heavy regulation often unintentionally fuels price increases. For the last 2 months, it seems they have already made their preemptive moves in response. Therefore, if you would like to buy properties now or in the near future, waiting for prices to be stabilized might be a little risky.
Okay, so if you are thinking of potentially buying a home, now might be the time to do so. Ms. Jin, what other real estate policies does the government have available, or what additional measures is it considering to deal with these high housing prices?
Well, after targeting multiple homeowners to rein in real estate speculation, the government now appears to be shifting its focus towards single homeowners who do not reside in their properties, with tax reform emerging as one such measure to curb speculative demand. Among the options potentially under consideration are changes to long-term holding deduction on capital gains from home sales, an issue brought into focus after President Lee Jae-myung questioned the appropriateness of tax breaks for long-term ownership of homes not used for residence. The deduction applies to capital gains tax on property with larger reductions for longer holding periods. Under the current system, owners of a single home held and occupied for more than 10 years can receive a combined 80% deduction, 40% for holding period and 40% for residency, effectively exempting most gains from tax. Against speculation over a possible overhaul of the system, Kim Yong-bum, head of policy at the presidential office, said earlier this week that the system will be maintained, but officials are reviewing whether applying the same 40% deduction rate to both holding and occupancy periods is consistent with a broader goal of steering the market toward owner-occupiers. Raising holding taxes is also emerging as a key issue, as the president has pointed to Korea's relatively low property tax burden compared with global peers. Some experts say that property tax rates could also be adjusted based on how long a property is held and whether it is actually used for occupancy.
Finally, Professor John, from your perspective, what more can the government realistically do to try and bring down or at least stabilize apartment prices in Seoul and the surrounding areas?
To effectively stabilize prices, the government must recognize that relying solely on strict regulations will not work. We should carefully evaluate the effectiveness of these regulations. And if needed, we should relax or ease ineffective or excessive ones to ensure market functioning. I would like to explain this on the supply and the demand side. On the supply side, while direct government supplied housing is important, its scale is inherently limited. So in Seoul, the key to expanding supply is supporting the private sector through urban redevelopment projects. The government is already trying to help by introducing diverse project models and integrated review processes, but there are still many issues to resolve. For example, the mandatory contribution of physical public rental housing acts as a major hurdle because it worsens project profitability. Adopting flexible alternatives such as in-lieu fees could be helpful as an idea. Relocation loans to tenants should be treated as business expenses rather than household debt, thereby exempting them from strict lending curbs to smooth out the redevelopment process. On the demand side, we should accept that investment demand for Seoul apartments will persist. Mm-hmm. When the government increases holding taxes, adjusting transaction taxes to a reasonable level would help prevent the market from freezing. If not, upward price pressure will spill over into relatively affordable housing, thereby increasing the housing cost burden for renters. For long-term stability, the government may consider adjusting mortgage limits for first-time home buyers. The consistent price increases not only worsen residential segregation, but also discourage affordable home ownership. It particularly leaves young people behind in their ability to build wealth through home ownership, ultimately deepening the wealth gap and inequality between generations. In that sense, the current loan caps could reflect the newly elevated price levels for first-time home buyers, ensuring that young renters are not entirely priced out of the market.
But we'll continue to follow this issue and how housing prices in Seoul and the surrounding areas react to current and future government measures. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Many thanks to Korea Jeongang Daily reporter Jin Min-ji. Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Jin.
Thank you for having me today.
And Professor Junjie Sheik of Konguk University, thank you so much for your insights, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Jocelyn Clark. I'm the first official non-Korean licensee of Gayagam Sanjo in Korea. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 7.95 points, or 0.11% on Friday, to close at 7,498. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 8.54 points, or 0.71%, to close at 1,207.72. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Daniel, what are we kicking things off with today?
A recent survey showed that more than half of grandparents in the nation said they were forced to make time to look after their grandchildren.
More than half. It's quite a staggering figure. Give us a breakdown of what the surveyed numbers showed.
Well, on Friday, the Korean Women's Development Institute shared the results of a 20-day online survey conducted in July last year on more than 1,000 grandparents with experience in caring for grandchildren. Over 53% said they were providing involuntary care, as in they did not want to do it, but were unable to refuse requests due to their children's circumstances. This burden was more pronounced among women, apparently, more than 57% of women, in contrast to 44% of men reporting involuntary care.
And what kinds of situations has led parents to call in grandparents for this extra help?
The main reasons that grandparental care was still required, even when public care services were available, included a parent's working hours, prioritization of family caregiving values, and the need for private education.
Okay, and what did this survey show about the demand and the toll that it takes on these grandparents?
Well, the surveyed grandparents care for their grandchildren an average of 4.6 days per week on weekdays for an average of 6 hours per day.
Wow.
So this amounts to an average weekly caregiving time of over 26 hours. The negative impacts of taking on such tasks, 73% reported an increase in physical fatigue, 60% reported increased psychological burden or stress. So 48% said pre-existing conditions, illnesses or pain worsened.
Okay, so any changes on the horizon that could try and help ease the burden on these older family members?
Well, the Institute stated that the survey results clearly showed that grandparents' care for grandchildren still plays a crucial role in filling childcare gaps. So officials highlighted the need to shift policies toward strengthening a public care system that guarantees parents time to care and provides trustworthy childcare options.
So this really points to a wider childcare gap. Even, as you said, Daniel, when public services exist, many families still relying heavily on grandparents to make their daily schedules work. Let's now move on to our next story for the day.
The Minister of Foreign Affairs appointed iconic soprano singer Jo Sumi, as a cultural cooperation ambassador for South Korea.
Well, she's a world-renowned singer. She's a Grammy Award winner who has continued to perform on international stages for decades now. What can you tell our listeners about her new role?
So every year, the Foreign Ministry grants the title Cultural Cooperation Ambassadors to private sector individuals with expertise in their fields who have also gained public recognition. Their job in this role is to promote Korean culture abroad at various events through their relationships and through official diplomatic platforms. Their appointment lasts for 1 year.
Well, it goes without saying that, of course, she's widely recognized for her musical talent, her international career. But Daniel, what about this kind of diplomatic role she's going to be taking on? Is this the first time she's taken on a post like this?
It's clearly not her first rodeo, not at all. This is not Sumijo's first time working in public diplomacy for South Korea. She was public relations ambassador for the 2002 World Cup. And more recently, in 2018 at the PyeongChang Olympics, she served in a few different promotional roles.
So plenty of experience. What kind of responsibilities will she be tasked with as a cultural cooperation ambassador?
Well, Jo's appointment is part of a broader K-initiative, that is the global expansion of K-culture. The main role would involve conducting outreach to expand global knowledge of Korean culture and public diplomacy. And she won't be at it alone. The foreign ministry also appointed Professor Lee Sung-hoon of Seonggonghae University as Ambassador of Human Rights, Peace and Democracy to serve a similar role with a focus on helping to expand government's participation in international discussions on human rights, peace and democracy by attending international forums and strengthening cooperation networks.
Right, let's move on and wrap things up now with our final story for today.
Some welcome news for cinephiles here in the nation. And government is distributing discount coupons for local cinemas.
Great news. When will these coupons be available? And what kind of discount are we talking about?
The Ministry of Culture, Sports and Tourism said Friday that starting 10 a.m. next Wednesday, a total of 2.25 million coupons will be given out. Each will provide a discount of 6,000 won or around $4. It will be limited to 2 per person on a first-come, first-served basis and can be downloaded through the websites and mobile apps of major theater chains.
And Daniel, what's the ministry's main reason for launching this movie discount event?
The main goal is to help support the local film industry, of course. It's part of an extra budget package aimed at stimulating domestic consumption and helping cinemas recover from years of sluggish attendance. The South Korean cinema sector has been facing severe multi-year downturn driven by a huge shift toward streaming platforms. Rising ticket prices didn't help in attracting consumers back to cinemas either.
Well, hopefully this does the job. Will it be a one-time offer or should moviegoers expect more events like this?
Well, the exact same number of discount coupons, 2.25 million, will be given out again in July. That is the peak summer blockbuster season. Check the Korean Film Council website for participating venues. And the coupons can be combined with existing discounts, including youth, senior, disability, and early morning promotions. And if you do not use them, the unused coupons will disappear once each theater chain exhausts its allotted supply.
And that's where we'll wrap up today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do I know you didn't abandon him to save your own skin?
No one feels as lost more than I.
Well, the next time I can get one of the pictures of the video.
It's time now for Movie Spotlight, your weekly ticket to the world of film, from the hottest blockbusters to hidden indie gems and everything in between. And joining us today in the studio is our resident movie critic, Singular. Darcy Paquette, you're flying solo this week. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So Darcy, the first film you're recommending this week, it's opened strongly around the world amidst a pretty intensive marketing campaign. That film is The Devil Wears Prada 2. It reunites its stars Meryl Streep, Anne Hathaway, Stanley Tucci, Emily Blunt, 20 years after the release of the original film. When I saw that it's been 20 years, I almost fell out of my chair. I thought it was like 5, right. But no, it's 20 years. And like, that sounds like most of the main cast. We are missing, of course, Adrien Grenier, who personally I thought was the main villain of the first film. But anyways, I'll digress. For those of our listeners who haven't seen it or maybe don't remember it because it was 20 years ago again, can you tell us a bit more about the original?
So the film is based on a 2003 novel of the same name. The novel is written by a woman named Lauren Weisberger, and it's about a young journalist who gets hired as the personal assistant of this powerful and domineering fashion magazine editor. And Weisberger in real life worked as the personal assistant of Vogue editor Anna Wintour, mm-hmm. So the book was seen kind of as this thinly veiled portrait depiction of the very this very famous person acting very badly. Mm-hmm. So it caused a bit of a sensation. You know, the film took that concept and ran with it. So they cast Meryl Streep, which is one of the great casting decisions of our day, mm-hmm. I think, to play Anna Wintour, or the Anna Wintour character. Anne Hathaway is the lead. And the first film was just a huge hit. You know, in the end, even Anna Wintour said that she liked it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even though, you know, I do think that her character, Meryl Streep's character, was supposed to be kind of a villain, there is a certain, like, look behind her as this, you know, boss figure and this woman in fashion so high up. 20 years is this long gap for a movie sequel. And the world, obviously, it's changed quite a bit in the interim. How did the filmmakers approach the challenge of creating a new film out of this material?
I mean, to a certain extent, it takes a different approach. It kind of abandons the central concept of the first film, which is, you know, I would argue the experience of working for an obsessive, manipulative, directorial, dictatorial boss. You know, that was something that a lot of people could relate to. And I think more generally, you know, when you're young, when you're getting your first job, one of the things you have to deal with is to, figure out how much of your job is going to take up your life.
Right.
What's your relationship to work going to be? And so, you know, the film, I think, spoke to a lot of people. And so even if they weren't that much into fashion or magazine publishing, you know, the film is remembered well by a lot of people. The new film, I mean, it raises a bunch of issues in the film. In some ways, it's kind of an issue film, which I found a bit curious. You know, it talks about the crisis facing journalism, magazine publishing. You know, it's kind of a lot about late-stage capitalism and AI and everything else. And so the focus is a little bit less on the relationship between the characters. I mean, we do get some thrown elbows between the lead characters, and but mostly, you know, the conflict in the film is not between the characters so much as just everybody's struggling to survive in this world that's kind of threatening to make them all irrelevant, even the Meryl Streep character.
Okay, sounds a bit downbeat for a film that kind of builds itself as a comedy. Is it able to balance those really serious issues with any kind of fun or more entertaining plot?
I mean, up to a certain point. I think the cast is, you know, very impressive. They were impressive in the first film. They're just as talented now. And the look of the film is quite impressive. You know, the fashion, they did a lot with that. You know, the first film, I think, it didn't have as many cameos in the first film because people weren't really quite sure if they wanted to appear in this film and potentially offend Anna Wintour.
Right.
But, you know, with this film, it's a huge list of cameos. I think that they, you know, created this on a really big scale. Mm-hmm. And so people who are interested in the fashion industry, I think, will find a lot in the film. I mean, that being said, you know, one thing that I did find quite disappointing was I thought the dialogue was kind of weak. And, you know, the first film, it had a lot of kind of memorable lines. Mm-hmm.
So many quotable lines. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of energy, you know, in the interactions between the characters. And here we have a really good actors speaking lines that to me felt really kind of flat.
Mm.
And, you know, I think Meryl Streep is good enough. I think she's one of the few people on the planet who can take bad dialogue and make it sound like good dialogue. But I was a bit disappointed with that. And I think that, you know, the basic setup of the plot, the fact that it's, again, it is kind of a downbeat story, you know, it's trying to say something meaningful about our lives today, but it is kind of a depressive situation for journalism, you know, for magazine publishing. And so, in a way, it's trying to do two things at once, and those two things don't always kind of mesh very well.
Mesh, right. How has the critical response been generally?
It's been interesting to see, like, it's been mixed, I guess, but mixed in a sense that, you know, there are still things in this film that people are really responding to, and then other things that people find disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
You can really sense from reading the reviews that there's, you know, a great deal of affection for the original film and for these characters and the actors. So, you know, I think people enjoyed being in their company for another 2 hours. You know, that being said, I think most of the reviews that I read all said, you know, it can't hold a candle to the first film.
Right.
You know, it's nice to kind of come back and see these characters again. But the question, I guess, is, you know, do you want to spend 2 hours watching this film, or do you want to go back and rewatch the original once again?
Oh, that's such a tough question. How about its box office prospects, both abroad and here in Korea?
I mean, globally, it's doing really, really well. So it opened with $233 million worldwide in its first weekend. And, you know, for a comedy of this type, that's a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has benefited from this really aggressive global marketing campaign by Disney.
Was the cast here in Seoul? Did I see that?
They did. Yeah, they did come here. And so they have put a lot of effort into it. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, the type of film that opens up a lot of marketing opportunities yes. as yeah. well. You know, in Korea, it's interesting because it opened the same day as the Super Mario Galaxy movie, which is appealing really strongly to kids. If you look at kind of box office to date in the U.S., the Super Mario movie is the only movie that seems to be making more money than this one. And so, you know, they did both open on the same day in Korea. You know, on the weekend, Super Mario kind of inches ahead and it takes the number one spot. On the weekdays, I think the kids stay home and then the adults come out and The Devil Wears Prada rises to number one. It's, you know, it's doing okay. I don't think it's putting up huge numbers yet, but it's also, it seems to be building a bit of momentum. So, you know, this could be the kind of film that just stays in theaters for a month or a month and a half and racks up some, you know, decent box office over that time.
Well, I'm going to actually do both. I'm going to go back and rewatch the original and then I'm going to go and see the sequel this weekend. I'm really looking forward to it because I'm just such a huge fan of that original cast. I think it's such an incredible lineup. So looking forward to seeing Meryl on the big screen. Darcy, your second pick for this week is the latest work by well-known Korean art house director Hong Sang-soo, The Day She Returns. It premiered earlier this year at the Berlin Film Festival's Panorama section, and it opened in local theatres on Wednesday. What can you tell us about it?
Yes, so if you look at Hong Sang-soo's films in recent years, he seems to kind of alternate between two types of films. You know, he's extremely prolific. He makes about two films per year on average. I think this is his 35th film, or I need to count again. It's somewhere like 34 or 35. But there do seem to be kind of two types, in that, you know, some of them have kind of a bit more plot, a bit more story in terms of character development and the events that are taking place on the screen, perhaps a bit more humor. And then some of his films are a bit more abstract, where the plot's less developed, but there's kind of this interesting structure that, you know, holds the film together and, you know, gives you a lot to think about. You know, visually too, he's kind of moving back and forth between black and white and color features. Occasionally, he's also kind of playing with focus as well.
A lot going on, sounds like.
Yes. And so from that perspective, we can say that this new film, The Day She Arrives, the Korean title, by the way, is 그녀가 들어온다. It's in black and white. It's a bit more on the abstract side. And, you know, there's very few depicted on screen in terms of events. In fact, it basically just shows us an actress giving interviews to support the release of her latest independent film. And so much of the film is, you know, her sitting at a table with a journalist and kind of answering questions. And then it gives us a little twist towards the end, but that is basically the entire film.
Okay. So sounds like there's not much of a plot. If you had to summarize it, I suppose, and I suppose not give away too much, Darcy, which is always the hard part of this job, what would you say?
Well, I mean, actually, let me read out the synopsis, which is written by the director.
Okay.
And I find these synopses fascinating. Like, he writes the synopses for all of his movies, and each of them is about a paragraph long, and, you know, he includes some details and he leaves some other details out, but it's always a slightly different perspective in which to look at the film. But the synopsis reads, you know, after getting married, she gave up acting. Then after getting divorced, she decided to work again and shot an independent film. Today, for the sake of that film's release, she is doing interviews. Having reached middle age, for the first time in a long while, she is presenting her face to the world as an actor. She does three interviews at 30-minute intervals and tries to answer each question as best she can. After the interviews, she goes to an acting class that she has recently joined. Her acting instructor tells her to try reenacting the interviews she did earlier that day. When she reaches the most important parts of the interviews, for some reason she can't remember a thing. She's tired and wants to go home. Her daughter is waiting.
Okay. Are we watching her reenactments or are we watching her interviews?
So in the later part of the film, she sits down together with another acting student. And the other acting student is the one who kind of takes on the role of the interviewers. And so the other person kind of memorizes the list of questions and then asks them. And then she basically tries to answer them in more or less the same way that we already saw on the screen earlier. You know, there are slight differences. You know, we hear kind of when she's answering these questions that, you know, she remembers something slightly different than perhaps it was in real life. And, you know, it's those kind of details that I guess we're meant to focus on as we watch the film. It's not that there are no big events in the plot to really grab our attention, but yeah, as is the case with a lot of his films, it's the small details that we are meant to kind of watch closely and try to process and then to think about them. And then to, each of us is kind of charged with the task of trying to draw our own meaning out of that.
Did you find it interesting?
I mean, it was interesting. I think that, you know, there's some intriguing repetitions to the film. You know, at the end of each interview, by coincidence, they all end up asking the same question, which is, you know, to this slightly older actress, like, do you have any advice that you'd like to give to younger generation people like us? And she answers the same way to all of them, like, love yourself. That's the most important thing. And, you know, there is some humor. You know, it's kind of early in the day, but I think that, you know, they're at this cafe that serves some delicious German beer, apparently, and she really wants a beer, but she doesn't want to order it herself. And so she keeps dropping hints that she wants to drink a beer with the interviewers, and they're saying, like, no, it's too early, I don't want to do that. And so, there are funny moments. I think the dialogue is consistently interesting, but definitely, like, you know, there's a certain type of viewer that I think this kind of film appeals to more. And yeah, so I, you know, when the film screened at Berlin, I was kind of both, you know, reading the official reviews, but also kind of looking, you know, for online comments from people I know. And, you know, some people were really excited about the film. Others were saying, oh, it feels a bit slight. So, yeah, I mean, it does produce those kinds of varying responses.
And Darcy, how would you say that it compares to Hong Sang-soo's other more recent works?
I mean, personally, I kind of prefer his more colorful, dynamic mode of filmmaking. He had one recently, By the Stream, which I really liked. And but again, like, you know, this film, I think that it's the type of film that the first time you see it, you're not really quite sure what to make of it. And then if you get the chance to sit down and watch it again, then you do find more the more kind of time and effort that you put into it. And, you know, he's made so many films by this point, but, you know, there are different places around the world that are arranging for retrospectives of his work these days. There's one in New York, there's one at Harvard University that's kind of taken place over the course of a year. And actually here in Seoul at the Korean Film Archive, they're planning over the next couple of months to screen all of his films from the past as well. And, you know, it's, I think his filmography is definitely worth revisiting. And the films, he's gone through these different stages in his career. You know, some people prefer his early stage, some people prefer his most recent stage, but they are quite different.
So it certainly sounds like it's a movie that you kind of get out what you put into it almost.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. And it's interesting, Darcy, that you mentioned that there's kind of a lot of retrospectives going on, or this director is being recognized in a lot of ways. What do you think makes him so unique?
I think that, I mean, it's both the way that he makes his films and the content of the films itself. You know, he has perfected working on a really low budget. You know, he shoots his films in like a week or 2 weeks. He doesn't write a script beforehand. He shows up on the set with a vague idea, and then he kind of follows his intuition rather than try to plan things out logically. I think he trusts his intuition more than he trusts his logical mind. And he's also minimized the number of people on the set so that, you know, partly I think as a way just to give him more freedom and to be able to shoot on a low budget. But when you look on the credits, you know, he's the director, screenwriter, cinematographer, editor, composer. he does pretty much everything. He's only one or two other people on the set helping him. And because his films, you know, again, he's not really kind of telling a story to entertain people. He's kind of taking these thoughts or feelings that are inside himself and then kind of pulling them out and then making them into stories in a way that he doesn't try to control the process too much. And so, yeah, they're very simple on the surface, and yet, you know, when you watch the film, there are interesting patterns that emerge in the film. There are different connections, and you know, the way that each film relates to other films of his is also quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just you know, it looks easy when you see his films that they're like, oh, that's kind of simple, like, you know, anybody could do that. But actually, if anybody else does it, it's not interesting. And I think that he's created a body of work that I think people will continue to come back to for many years in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, from the glossy return of The Devil Wears Prada 2 to the quieter, more elusive world of Hong Sang-soo's The Day She Returns, there's certainly plenty for moviegoers to think about, whether they're heading to the multiplex or the art house. That's where we're going to leave this week's movie spotlight. Darcy Paquette, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back next week with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. Korea 24 is produced by Daria Kim, Yoon So-hyang and Kim Bum-soo, and I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us, and until next time, take care and goodbye.